from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the hands of ISIS, the Islamic State, social media have been weaponized. Yesterday, another salvo, horrific video of another American journalist, Stephen Sotloff, and his beheading, straight to the web and around the world. ISIS is using social media to recruit, to terrorize, to taunt. This hour on Point, another gruesome beheading and social media in the ISIS grab for power. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Should we try to shut these images down? Can that be done? Should that be done? Do you see social media emerging here as a key weapon? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Baltimore is Scott Shane, national security reporter for the New York Times. Scott, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
You have described how, along with Ben Hubbard, how ISIS has put its use of social media right in the heart of its strategy of taking over territory in the Middle East, in the deserts of Syria and Iraq. What's the role it's playing again today with this terrible killing on video all over the web of Stephen Sotloff?
Yeah, one of the remarkable things about ISIS, this group that controls a lot of territory now in Iraq and Syria, is that even though their methods many people see as barbaric, certainly, their message, I think, strikes many people as medieval, their sort of dissemination of their message is very 21st century. And, you know, after taking a look at a lot of this propaganda, we realized that Osama bin Laden had sort of been the first generation of using first pre-internet media with sort of smuggled videotapes to Al Jazeera, and you know, people can picture him sort of standing in front of a video camera reading something. The second generation might be Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born Yemeni cleric who spoke in a much more understandable, approachable style in colloquial English. He had a blog. He had a Facebook page. They were both killed, bin Laden and al-Awlaki, by the Americans. And now there's this sort of third generation, which is very sophisticated in its video production, in its use of Twitter and other social media to get this message out around the world.
All they have to do is video it, and out it goes. You describe them using Instagram and SoundCloud and WhatsApp and, of course, Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. Last time after the killing of James Foley, there were some attempts to shut this down on Twitter and beyond. Accounts closed. At a certain point, that becomes difficult to do. Is there such an attempt underway again with the killing of Stephen Sotloff, trying to shut off the tap of social media?
You know, I think the British have talked about taking down some inflammatory material, and there has been a bit of a movement out there to do what people call a media blackout of ISIS. But I think it's probably fair to say these attempts will fail. You know, an interesting precedent is Anwar al-Awlaki, who also had a bunch of audio and video recordings which are extremely influential. And at one point, before he was killed, there was a push in Congress, in the U.S. Congress, among other places, to lobby YouTube to take down his many, many videos on YouTube. And YouTube actually agreed to do that, started to do that. But the fact is that the way these things work, so many hours of video are posted by individuals to YouTube every minute that the company cannot actually screen it all. And if you look at YouTube today, there's lots and lots of al-Awlaki material. So it doesn't seem like you can really censor it in that sense. The alternate approach has been to try and to push back against it using the same techniques.
Scott Shane, I appreciate your being with us today. You're beginning to break up on us, and I'm sorry for that, but we appreciate your reporting on this. And you're bringing us up to date on the latest use of social media, Jihad 3.0, you've called it, along with Ben Hubbard in the pages of the New York Times. Scott Shane, thanks for joining us there from Baltimore. We'll have a better line next time. With us right now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is Zeynep Tufekci. She is professor at the School of Information and Library Science at the University of North Carolina, Turkish-American, faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Zeynep, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
How do you interpret this latest beheading and its the impact of all the social media cultivation that ISIS has done in its onslaught in the region this summer?
Right. So there are, I think, three dimensions to what ISIS is doing. And the most important one is that it's using its social media to intimidate local populations. I liken this a little bit like to a blowfish that likes to appear bigger. It's been steadily aiming these videos. I mean, we see the ones of Western journalists, but there has been a steady stream of local people from Syria and Iraq who were being killed, who were being murdered, executed in large numbers, and these being put online. For example, before their assault on Mosul, which was a turning point for them, they showed up at the house of a Sunni police chief on video. Mm-hmm. They blindfolded the poor man in his house. They beheaded him in his house. This is an hour-long gruesome video. They killed him. And it was clearly meant to intimidate, and they released this. And when they attacked Mosul and the areas around there, people were understandably very scared, and security forces, a lot of them crumbled or ran. So
because the web spreads the words, and if everybody knew about it in advance of their even arriving, sort of like Genghis Khan
exactly.
in the old days.
And it's also like a blowfish puffing up, right? Yeah. It makes them look much stronger than they are. Of course, it's unfortunately a self-fulfilling prophecy because once you conquer Mosul, you are stronger. So mm-hmm. the fact that they've been able to amplify their voice is very important for them. The second thing they're doing is recruiting. And as far as we can tell, they seem to be recruiting troubled young men with promises of, you know, lots of guns and a cause, which is an age-old story. I mean, you know, this is not a very unusual happening, you know, guns and a cause. A lot of the young people they're recruiting seem to be new converts to Islam, and they have all the zealotry that comes with that. You know, they're young, and they just think they found some great cause, and they get to play with machines and guns.
You could see religious zealotry being the motivator here, but with all this gruesome footage, you could also just see this recruiting psychopaths from all over the world. Here's a free fire
absolutely,
zone. Come and
absolutely,
you can do whatever.
Absolutely. So the thing is, like, there's research on militaries, and militaries have to train people to kill, right? It's not an easy thing. Militaries have to overcome our very natural and human aversion to pulling the trigger. It takes a lot of training to make that automatic. But research shows there's like 1 to 2% of the population that wants to kill. And
here's a black flag saying, come here, you can do all you want.
Yeah, and sane militaries actually, while trying to train 99% of their, you know, recruits to kill on command, they are trying to keep out that 1% that wants to kill.
Sane militaries, you say, right.
Correct. So the third thing is these videos. So let's come to that. I'm not sure that they really have a brilliant strategy behind these videos.
You're talking about the beheading videos, James
Foley.
Correct.
The ones that we see a lot, not the ones that are flooding the region, because clearly, as the previous guest said, there is a generation that's very social media savvy. So they know how the medium works. I mean, if in an alternate universe, these kids might have been making a lot of money on YouTube on reviews of video games or makeup tutorials. You know, they know, they get in their heart how the medium works. So they're very good at publicizing. But I'm not really sure they understand the U.S. public or U.S. politics as well. In fact, if you look at the history of this, there is often a huge divide within, you know, al-Qaeda-like organizations, which may be terrorist organizations, but they're also political organizations with political goals, as sort of usually the grown-ups, quote-unquote, debate whether this is just backfiring. In fact, we've seen some of ISIS's killings of local villagers causing backlash among even their supporters. At the moment, they're kind of like a startup running on momentum. You know, nothing succeeds like success. So that's kind of working, but I don't really want to exaggerate how brilliant and amazing they are with their social media, because I think in some ways, yes, but there's a lot of bravado and young
male. Could come back to bite them as well.
A lot of things going on.
I mean, there's been so much of it. All those vehicles racing across the desert, black flags flying, all those young men.
The videos look like Halo, or, you know, they look like they're high definition. They're cut very well. They look like video game. I mean, they've got
But gruesome, too. I mean, scores, hundreds being marched to their deaths, beheadings.
Right.
Not just these Americans, but many others. You write, I mean, everybody's in social media these days. You're on Twitter. You're writing here, absolutely meticulous message control to intimidate, to terrorize, to recruit has been integral to ISIS strategy and conquest from day one. And you write, killing journalists is not merely a byproduct of cruelty. It's a deliberate strategy of message control. They want only their voice out there, no other eyes on the scene.
That's exactly right. And I think, so this is where I want to say that it's not true that there's nothing that can be done. I mean, it's true there's nothing can be done to completely censor them off the internet. That is not true. But look, if they had used the Beyoncé track, they would have been off all of YouTube and all of Twitter. So we do have mechanisms to push back against intimidation of this kind online.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about another ISIS beheading. It's out on the web. And ISIS's pointed use of social media in its bloody grab for power. It looked great in Tahrir Square social media. It doesn't look so great in the deserts of Syria and Iraq in the would-be caliphate. On the day after, we've seen evidence now confirmed by U.S. officials of the murder, beheading, of Stephen Sutloff, American journalist, 31 years old, very brave. He had been out there telling the story of this region. He won't be doing that now, and it is stomach-turning. Why is ISIS social media presence drawing followers? Who does this appeal to? Who does it terrorize? Do they look like an irresistible force online? And should we be trying to shut it down, to block it all over? Is that an option in this age? Should, in principle, is that acceptable? Strategically, look back on propaganda across different war in different times in history. Plenty of it out there, marauding, advancing ISIS. Here's a recruitment video, a little bit, for ISIS released in June. Features English-speaking jihadis from the United Kingdom and Australia encouraging Western Muslims to join.
Oh, my brothers, living in the West, I know how you feel when I used to live there. In the heart, you feel depressed. Prophet said, the cure for the depression is jihad fi sabilillah.
The cure for depression is jihad, and that's out there all over, easily found. President Obama responding to the latest beheading here, saying these acts will only unite us and stiffen our resolve.
Whatever these murderers think they'll achieve by killing innocent Americans like Stephen, they have already failed. They failed because, like people around the world, Americans are repulsed by their barbarism. We will not be intimidated. Their horrific acts only unite us as a country and stiffen our resolve to take the fight against these terrorists.
But social media just keeps seeing the videos coming. And this, the one yesterday, the second beheading of an American journalist with that, you know, the orange outfit, the guy in black in the desert with the British accent here speaking to the American president for all the world to listen.
I'm back, Obama, and I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State, because of your insistence in continuing your bombings in Al-Marli, Zamara, and the Mosul Dam, despite our serious warnings. You, Obama, have yet again, through your actions, killed yet another American citizen. So just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the next of your people.
It's sobering, it's infuriating, it's all over social media, which is being wielded here as information and propaganda, long has, but now with much more reach, as a kind of weapon of war. Zeynep Tufekci is with us. She's professor at the School of Information Library Science at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Turkish American, great to have you with us, Zeynep. With us right now from Savannah, Georgia, is Patrick Skinner, expert on ISIS and al-Qaeda, former CIA case officer, now director of special projects for the Sufan Group, which provides security intelligence to governments, multinational organizations. Patrick Skinner, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Should these videos be taken down off Twitter, YouTube, you name it?
Well, they are, but it's a game of whack-a-mole. One pops up, you take it down, three more pop up. It's against the use rules of YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook to post such violent imagery. And when it's reported, people will take it down, but then they just shift it over. Or they're using a Dropbox account service called Just Paste It, where anybody can go get the link. And so there are more avenues than there are ways to shut it down.
Is this different from propaganda in previous eras?
Well, I think it's different in the manner that everybody is now a minister of propaganda. And just 15 years ago, only corporations or governments had the means of distribution. Everybody could make a tape. The Shah of Iran in the 70s made audio tapes and smuggled them from Paris into Iran. And they, you know, people listened to them. They bought them on the street. But nowadays, you don't need that. Everybody is their own minister of propaganda, and you have infinite distribution. And if someone shuts you down, and I've been spending far too much time looking at these Twitter accounts in the last couple of weeks, and they get shut down, some of them regularly, like every day, and they just pop up by adding another one, and their friends then post their name and say, hey, everybody, Mujahid for Life is now this person.
And the beheading really lives on social media. How important, how influential do you see this social media presence being for ISIS? Is it no big deal, just kind of a side dish? Is it central to their, this summer, rather successful push?
I think it's essential to them. One, the conditions on the ground helped create ISIS. Iraq was a mess, Syria is in a complete free fall. And so that creates, you know, ISIS's true power, but they can help spread it. And like your other guest said, the blowfish, they can inflate themselves, and they've done it pretty well by manipulating media. But there's also a misconception that there's just one universe in Twitter, Twitterverse, if you will. Mm-hmm. There's actually many multi-Twitterverses. And so what we've seen in the West, where it's a hashtag-dominated way, and we can kind of track these, oh, ISIS has been mentioned 4.3 million times in the last 30 days. Mm-hmm. That is not what the target audience is. They're in a different universe.
What are they seeing that we're not? What's the difference?
Well, what they're doing is they're talking directly to each other. They're engaged like an open conversation where they go back and forth. They don't post a lot. They just reply on Twitter directly to people, and they ask questions. And they'll say like kick, K-I-K me, which means direct, you know, message me, and they'll go offline that way. Or they'll go set up a page on ask.fm where they'll start talking back and forth about how do I get to Syria or how do I get to Turkey. But on the Twitterverse, for them, they are going back and forth at huge numbers, taunting each other or explaining. And it's a warped conversation, but it's an actual conversation. And in the West, we use Twitter to, you know, announce what we just did, or it's not a conversation.
It's not pretty, but it's very real, and it's having a real impact on the ground in the world where so many have been slaughtered this summer, now two American journalists among them, but many, many others, as Zeynep Tufekci reminds us in her own tweet. Just a few days ago, there was a video of hundreds of Syrian men marched to their execution by ISIS, deliberate campaign of intimidation. Zeynep, Patrick, please stand by. Lots of callers for you. Norman in Cleveland. Norman, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We used to call this in the 60s, we used to call them snuff videos. And they were horrible. Kids are seeing this. I saw yesterday a video of somebody being buried alive. A number of people being shot in the back of their heads. It's not just journalists, it's people.
Yeah.
And I wish that there was some way that this could be kept off, and I don't know the answer. It's just horrible, and you know, children are seeing.
Yeah, Norman, let us pick it up right there. Zeynep, you were saying if it were a Beyonce music track, I guess the copyright owners would track it down and get it off. Here, Norman goes all the way back to snuff films in the 60s, says he sees the same thing here, and it should not be up. But is it corrallable?
It is. I mean, I don't want to say it's completely censorable because, as your other guest says, they'll pop up, but it's absolutely possible to make publicity harder for them. We have, you know, these platforms, they fight all the time against spam, right? Nobody worries about free speech rights of spammers, and they keep it off fairly. I mean, we get some, but they make life much harder for spammers. If you have an unauthorized Beyonce track on these ISIS videos, they probably would have been taken down faster if they used Bob Dylan unauthorized. You know, there's a lot of technologies and some human resources that could make it much harder for them. Again, given the nature of the internet, you know, they might restart a new Twitter account, yep, and they might post it on, you know, Vimeo or some other place. But it's not the same. There's a reason governments also try to censor in the same way, because if you're constantly fighting an active effort to keep you off a platform, you may be able to survive, but you're not going to have the same reach. You're not going to have the same publicity. I think what has happened is at first, the companies, the platforms were worried on a couple of things. One, there's news value to this, right? There's clearly news value. And I think that can be handled. You know, we can give the news without giving it on their terms. I mean, the reason they get
some news organizations are doing that.
Correct.
CNN,
right.
Al Jazeera, they're only showing so much of these videos.
Right.
Quite a circumscribed.
It's obviously news, and we could give the news without letting ISIS have the news on its own terms, right? Because that's why they're killing journalists.
But
they
that's not that easy to do. I mean, they want people to see pictures of them marauding across the desert, black flags flying. Well,
sure.
You could shut that down, but that also is actually happening, and then you don't know. Zeynep, hold the thought. Patrick, I'll come to you as well. I mean, maybe we could rein it in, but there is the question in this day and age where this is where so much news comes out. Should we rein it in? Randy in Atlanta, Georgia. Randy, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't care to view this horrific video, but I don't want others deciding for me what I can or cannot view on the web. I think it infringes on our rights. And secondly, I think actually the more that this is used, the more people get involved in the conversation. I think it will cause a backlash against ISIS because this is not going to be tolerated, not just by the U.S., but globally. And I'll just listen offline. Thank
Randy, I appreciate your call from Atlanta. At some point, it will bite then. Let me get one more, and I'll bring it to you, Patrick. Rachel in Austin, Texas. Rachel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I feel like, you know, we can do our part and the media can do their part, because just talking about it, just showing these videos, even partial videos that they showed on CNN,
yep,
I couldn't even watch that last night on CNN.
Yep.
I feel like this is exactly what they want. This is exactly what they want, is to make this huge media uproar. And then they're just going to keep killing people because they are getting exactly what they want out of it. They're getting more free airtime. And, you know, I feel like we should just go silent on it. Just like when these people were kidnapped, you don't hear daily, because the families want this quiet. They don't want it sensationalized.
But Rachel, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but forgive me, but ISIS has taken over a pretty good-sized chunk of terrain. This isn't just a game online. I mean, if we go quiet about it, we don't know what's going on.
Right, but they're killing Americans to show everybody, look at us. We're taking over a big piece of terrain. I mean, we're giving them exactly what they want. We're giving them the free airtime, and I don't feel like they're just going to continue to kill Americans, because that's how they get, you know, when they were just taking over the huge chunk, they weren't getting as much, you know, airtime in the media. So now we're just showing the world.
Rachel, I appreciate your call as well from Austin. Thank you very much. Patrick Skinner, at first, should everybody just go radio silent on ISIS? Is that a cure here? And then to Rachel's point about killing Americans, why are they killing Americans, Patrick?
Well, to the first point, going radio silent probably isn't an option. If you have cancer and don't talk about it, you still have cancer. And as you noted, ISIS has taken over actual land and they've done actual atrocities. Now, should they be glorified? No, of course not. There is a somewhat small movement called hashtag Islamic Media Blackout that they started after Foley. And it's been mentioned maybe 29,000 times in the last week or two. But then again, ISIS has been mentioned 4 million times. Mm. So any attempt, I mean, it's a personal choice. You can view it or not. I don't view these things.
Yep.
But there are the target audience is not us, and they are going to view it. And so pretending that they're not probably won't help.
Why are they targeting these Americans? They say, we're doing this because you bombed us. Don't bomb us.
I don't think that's probably accurate. I mean, I'm sure they're not happy about the bombing, but they didn't need another reason to be angry with us. They're violent, nihilist extremists. That's what they do. And so there is some kind of strategy. They are not supervillains, and not every decision they make is five pieces ahead on a chessboard. We shouldn't give them that power. But they are quite deliberate, and they have maintained, with some exceptions, very good media discipline. And they just put out an order, they called it Order Number 7 last week, that forbid anybody from leaking videos. And so they're trying to control their message. The attacks on Americans are directly at U.S. policy. They want a reaction. In fact, they want an overreaction. And they want us to intervene into Syria, because that is, right now there's a very chaotic battlefield. ISIS is fighting every other extremist group, plus Assad, plus the Kurds, plus Iraq, and the U.S. a little bit. And so, but if the U.S. gets involved rashly in Syria and starts killing civilians or killing other groups, which is going to happen because airstrikes are not surgical, that'll create a common enemy. And that's what these beheading videos right now, in my opinion, are. They want to terrorize, sure, but they also want to inflame and cause rash individual decisions.
Zeynep, do you see a kind of red cape waving here trying to draw the United States in with these terrible scenes, videos online?
Well, it's hard to know for sure. You know, that's one possible interpretation. And the other possible interpretation is that, you know, as he said, this is not some chess game where they have five pieces, you know, they've thought five moves ahead. And they're actually trying to keep the United States away in their mind. I mean, I genuinely don't think they understand U.S. politics that well. So I'm not sure they have that well thought out a strategy. It's possible. But I do want to go back to one point. When you might remember that ISIS comes from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, was a spinoff, complicated history there, which had started beheading Americans. Nicholas Berg was one of the first.
Back in the days
Iraq.
When there was no YouTube,
correct.
No Twitter.
And there was a whole, it was posted on a Malaysian website. There was a whole week of media coverage on it, and they repeated it, and there was a lot of media coverage. And there's a study that shows that once the media got a little bored with the story, to be honest, they stopped the beheadings, right? Because since this is a media strategy, I'm not talking about censoring the news. Of course, it has news value. But as everybody keeps saying, they have great message control. And the way media and publics react to their message absolutely has an impact. So if they're not getting the kind of publicity they want on their own terms, it has an impact on what they do.
So are you with Rachel then? Are you with Rachel in Austin, Texas,
well,
saying don't talk about them?
No, that's not it. I'm saying don't talk about them in their own terms. Do not give them that much control over media message, which is possible to do. We talk about how when Richard Engel was kidnapped in Syria, all media knew about it, and we all sat on it because, you know, you didn't want to endanger. There are times when you talk about what is news, but look at this has taken over the news cycle. It's an awful story. It's a horrific story. But they've been killing Iraqis and Syrians in large numbers over the past, you know, year. And we haven't been covering it. And now they kill an American and they got all the media they want. They'll probably try again until it stops working.
I saw a lot of ISIS before these beheadings. I saw plenty on the news.
You didn't see a lot on CNN like this, the way, like Nicholas Berg's coverage was like
the. Not wall to wall, that's right. That's true.
Not wall to wall. It's the same thing. It's the same dynamic of publicity and strategizing. I don't want to think they're brilliant, but I think they do react to how they get perceived and carried.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about another ISIS beheading. It's out on the web. And ISIS pointed use of social media in its bloody grab for power. Social media looked pretty great in Tahrir Square in Egypt when it was pro-democracy against a dictator. It does not look so great in the deserts of Syria and Iraq in the would-be caliphate of the Islamic State. With the beheading of the American journalist James Foley was released 2 weeks ago, apparently by a British subject, judging from the accent. Prime Minister David Cameron responded, calling it a barbaric and brutal act.
We know that far too many British citizens have travelled to Iraq and travelled to Syria to take part in extremism and violence. And what we must do is redouble all our efforts to stop people going, to take away the passports of those contemplating travel, to arrest and prosecute those that take part in this extremism and violence, to take extremist material off the internet, and do everything we can to keep our people safe.
an interview in June with CNN, an ISIS defector in hiding described how ISIS uses social media to recruit new members. He was part of an office that ran a welcome online chat about life under ISIS.
There are some questions I am allowed to answer, he says, then things I must ask my supervisor about. Specific questions about religion. I have to get their permission to message anyone. I can't talk on Skype. Everything is written down so they can monitor everything.
Meticulous message control, says my guest Zeynep Tafukci today. She joins us from the University of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, also a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Patrick Skinner is with us from Savannah, Georgia, expert on ISIS, Al-Qaeda, former CIA case officer, director of special projects for the Sufan Group, which is following all of this. And with us right now from Monterey, California, and it's been a while, I'm glad to have him back with us, is John Arquilla, professor and chair of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School, author of Insurgents, Raiders, and Bandits. John Arquilla, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
Talk to us, if you would. You study warfare and conflict. Social media are now a piece of it. How important, how effective, and what kind of response are you imagining will be effective against this barrage of images, and I guess you call it propaganda?
Well, several years back when Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was doing some very, very bad things in Iraq, Dr. Zawahiri, the then number two in al-Qaeda, sent him a letter saying, be careful about killing other Muslims because this war will be won. More than half of this battle is the battle of the story. And I think Dr. Zawahiri is right. This social media has a tremendous amplifying effect on virtually any item, whether the initial advance of ISIS, which I think was inflated a bit, the speed and depth of their advance, and now these events with the atrocities they're committing. The question for us, and I think both Zaina and Patrick have put it very, very well, these videos are about incitement, they're about intimidation, and the last point about a provocation strategy is very important as well. These single acts really radiate in all those directions. And for the United States, we see already that there's some debate that the president needs to do a great deal more. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs has said ISIS cannot be defeated just in Iraq, which implies having to operate in Syria. And that escalation would profoundly complicate the conflict, as it would end the tacit cooperation. If we began to work again in Syria, this would probably tear our tacit cooperation with Iran that's going on in Iraq at the moment. And the many Sunni countries supporting ISIS and the Sunni insurgents in Syria would have great tension with us. And we have to remember that this messaging, we're talking a lot about the conduits, but not as much about the content here. And what really underlies this is a Shia-Sunni civil war. Dispossessed Sunnis in Iraq want to better their position, and the majority Sunni in Syria want to overthrow an Alawite dictatorship. And until we begin to address those issues, and the president, President Obama, is trying to do this, for example, in Iraq, by getting better governance, more inclusive governance there. I think in Syria, what it means for policy is, and you're starting to hear this a little bit now, a bit of a willingness to live with Assad still in power, so long as some kind of peace would see liberalization in the society. It reminds me very much of what the British labor leader in World War I said in a letter to Woodrow Wilson. We should really be thinking about peace without victory rather than victory without peace. That is, a victory that would leave disgruntled losers on one side. And I think that's the way we're going to find the path to peace here.
John Arquilla, you put this story as how we, and you put it in terms of Shia-Sunni civil war. We talked earlier with Scott Shane of the New York Times. He and Ben Hubbard in their recent piece put it a little differently. Let me just read how he described how ISIS frames the story. He said, ISIS media, social media included, frames its campaign in epical terms, mounting a frontal assault on the national divisions and boundaries in the Middle East drawn by Western powers after World War I. These, quote-unquote, crusader partitions, they call them, and their modern Arab leaders
ISIS argues, the New York Times says, were a divide-and-conquer strategy intended to prevent Muslims from unifying under one imam carrying the banner of truth, the caliph. Times saying ISIS claims to have taken a major first step toward righting what it sees as this ancient wrong, creating a unified Muslim state that will subsume existing nations. That doesn't sound like a recipe anywhere in the visible future for peace, John.
Well, it's quite a bit of rhetorical flourish, and I think Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi himself knows how unrealistic it is. And let's put it very practically. ISIS wouldn't be where they are in Iraq without the support of a large Sunni uprising. After we walked away from Iraq at the end of 2011, the Shia government under Maliki dispossessed the Sunnis. So we had given them a modicum of equality in that awakening movement, and they came along with the idea of Iraqi democracy, and they were quickly disabused of the notion of cooperation. And so ISIS comes along very conveniently and creates a vehicle for them to recapture some of that influence in their society. So I see this as much more localized and much less grand than is being portrayed.
Zeynep, many Turks, we're told. I mean, 100 Americans maybe, 1,000-plus Europeans have joined ISIS. Many Turks, we're told, have come across the border. You're Turkish-American. What do you see as the most powerful story here, the caliphate story? We're going to erase these imperialist imposed boundaries and bring one big unified Islamic world, or the story of Shia-Sunni civil war?
Well, a little of everything, obviously, but to put things into perspective, the number reportedly joined from Turkey is about 400. The number from countries like Jordan and Tunisia, which have much higher numbers, is in a couple thousands. The number from UK is maybe 1,000. I'm saying these numbers because these aren't actually very, very large numbers. What is happening is...
You're saying they are not large numbers?
No, they're not. They're not. If you think about it, you know, there's a billion Muslims in the world. And if you're talking about maybe a small number of troubled young men who can be attracted, the problem is once you have the chaotic situation you have with the sort of the Syrian situation and the Iraqi government crumbling and everything else going on there, it's possible for a small number of not, you know, somewhat equipped, and they've taken over a lot of, you know, American equipment as well, and they got some hardware and armor,
yeah,
which makes a
it.
Difference.
Mm-hmm.
They can, along with an intimidation campaign, they can cause a lot of damage. In a lot of places, the populations fled rather than fought.
Mm-hmm.
So to understand this, you have to consider the ground in which they're operating. If there had been stable democratic governments in the area, you know, a couple thousand men showing up with guns is a problem, but it's not what it has become. I do want to say, their messaging is not necessarily to the broader Muslim world, because it doesn't really work. I mean, beheading, you know, random Americans gains no sympathy in 99% of the Muslim world. It just, like any other awful act, people sympathize with the victim. But their recruitment is from a small slice who can be, you know, seduced to join this. And that, as long as that's a large enough number, they're going to have these problems. And it's not going to be very attractive outside of that particular area. But I do want to add one thing. Mm-hmm. In Syria, the first groups that were fighting with ISIS were also other Sunni groups from across the political range, some al-Qaeda affiliates, some
sure.
not. So it's not even true that, you know, every Sunni group in the – it's a very political, competitive environment. So it's not – everybody's fighting for the same base,
yeah,
so to speak.
Patrick Skinner, to many people, this is repulsive. And as Zeynep says, including to, no doubt, many Muslims. But clearly it's thrilling to some. I mean, that's what's brought people to their side. If it's thrilling some, what's thrilling about it? If it's beyond just psychopaths who see a chance to butcher here – is the notion of a caliphate thrilling to enough to put together an effective fighting force? It has looked so this summer.
Well, it appeals to disaffected youth. I mean, think of parents trying to explain in long detail why doing the right thing might not be exciting, but it sure will pay off in 5 years. And compared to, you know, the devil on your shoulder saying, just do it. And Twitter, with its 140 characters, it is perfectly designed for this simplistic message that appeals on emotion. And so you'll see Sykes-Picot, the treaty that established the modern borders after World War One. You know, Sykes-Picot is gone. Well, of course it's not, and ISIS is not actually going to take over the Middle East. They have taken over parts of countries that are in complete collapse, and so they're not an occupying army. They look more like chicken pox, just dots of control. And so, but for teenagers, and it's important when, you know, I think, oh, I would be repulsed by a beheading video, and I am repulsed. But again, I'm not an ISIS potential recruit. And so if I was 19 and I lived in some sort of despair and I had some kind of psychological wound, ISIS has a very powerful narrative. John is right. It is a battle of narrative, and their narrative is incredibly compelling to somebody who's reaching for anything. A drowning man will grab any life preserver, and he won't care if it says ISIS on it. And so we're not presenting ours because it's difficult to present complicated solutions in 140 characters. Their production values are beyond professional. They make jihad look like a video game, and they play the savagery up, and then at the same time they show a jihadist holding a kitten or show how great it is sitting around the campfire. So they appeal to both.
Mohammed is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mohammed, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for allowing me. Well, I would like to make a statement about the caliphate that is being portrayed here by Baghdadi. The caliphate is the aspiration of 1.2 billion across the globe. And this, I hope also I can make a follow-up after your response. The caliphate is
You're saying it's the aspiration of all Muslims when you say 1.2 billion.
Yeah, pretty much. It is.
Why?
I mean, it's a natural habitat for Muslims. And Hizb ut-Tahrir is a grassroots political organization. Since 1953, he has put down the rules for caliphs.
So are you glad for the Islamic State and what it's done this summer, Mohammed?
What I am saying that this is a preemptive frame against the caliphate that Muslim wants. It is a very distorted face about the caliphate. And I think I see the footprint of the West and especially the United States to avert the inevitable growth of Muslim toward the real caliphate, which will bring the super state in the Muslim world that will be countering the super state of the United States.
You're saying ISIS is an American creation, but it's not like the real caliphate should be. Why? What's wrong with the ISIS version?
The ISIS is number one is imposing a man against the will of the nation of Muslims, which is against Islam. Muhammad, the prophet, he has not allowed himself to be a leader, the first leader in Medina, without taking the consent of the people of the Medina. He has hijacked the people of Mosul and beheaded anyone who is contrary to him. He is against the prophet of Islam. He is just another Karzai, but with a turban over him.
Mohammed, I appreciate your call. Our time is short before the break. John Arquilla, our caller in Milwaukee, Mohammed, talking about al-Baghdadi, the head of the Islamic State, you know, saying this isn't the real deal. He's a pretender. But saying the caliphate is the aspiration of 1.2 billion, that is all Muslims in our Mohammed's telling.
Well, certainly all the public opinion data we have reflect that the vast majority of the world's 1.2 or 1.3 billion Muslims reject the notion of a caliphate running from Madrid to Mindanao, basically the
Philippines, Muslim,
the middle. Exactly. And more importantly, upwards of 95% of all Muslims reject the methods being employed by ISIS. Again, I think this is a more localized problem. And it demands from us a strategy that focuses on more localized solutions.
What's that strategy? Because a lot of Muslims are clearly not entirely happy either with what's going on in the Muslim homeland for a long time.
Well, sure. I think in Iraq we have to see more inclusive governance of the sort that existed until we walked away at the end of 2011. In Syria, I think clearly peace without victory on any side is the solution. Bashar could probably stay in office, but would have to give concessions of a liberalizing sort, and the military and intelligence barons who've been running that country have to be moved into the background there. This is a stinking solution, but it is far superior to the kind of disorder created by our invasion in 2003. It's really funny. A group of Americans fomented war for the idea of democracy in the Middle East in 2003. They called for transformation. Well, they got transformation, but it is violent, it's insurgent, it's terrorist in nature. And even the Arab Spring, we see, has brought democracy for a bit, and then it's gone sour in Libya, in Egypt. And so I think there's a profoundly cautionary tale for the United States here, and I appreciate that President Obama is taking a cautious approach to this.
Zainab, we just have half a minute. If the social media is all about message, what do you see as the best message for defusing, or the best act?
Well, ironically, because there's so much information, there's no message like actual policy. And I think policies that support genuine democracy, genuine growth, genuine stability. And I completely agree with the other guests that the Iraq occupation set off a lot of these things. So changing policy on the ground is the best message. I don't think you can overcome that with just sort of publicity.
Takes us right back to reality beyond social media, potent as it may be. Zainab Tufekci at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you very much for joining us today, Zainab. I hope we talk again.
Thank you.
Patrick Skinner at the Sufan Group, joining us from Savannah, Georgia. Mr. Skinner, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome, Tom.
And John Arquilla at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Thank you, John. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.